From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I can't tell you how much we appreciate that donation. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
In an age of shifting truth and moment-to-moment revisionism, we are still able to see and hear statements made on camera. So despite years of spin and fear-mongering, the current president of the United States really did launch his campaign with that unambiguous scare-mongering rhetoric. He did say total, and he most definitely did say Muslim. Most courts have rightfully blocked this policy, but not all. So it's important to address this issue at the legislative level, which is now happening with the No Ban Act. This initiative is receiving widespread support from the multi-faith community, and we'll get a briefing on just that from Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance.
For me, being a progressive Christian means that I'm sort of always in this tension of fighting for the church and with the church. And when you have issues like we have with immigration or with survivors of sexual assault, with racism, you have an opportunity to step into those, but it's really difficult to weed through that tension.
John Pavlovitz is a progressive Christian pastor and popular author whose raw musings about the times we live in are read by millions online. John's most recent book is titled, I love this, Hope and Other Superpowers, a life-affirming, love-defending, butt-kicking, world-saving manifesto. And we'll delve into all of that on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
one thing that history has made clear is that people change and laws change and our nation changes. But it never, ever happens on its own. It happens because people like us stand up and say, we're going forward together. We're journeying together towards equality and justice and love, and I could not be more honored than to be on this journey with you. Thank you.
There's plenty of good news to be found in the South, and a lot of the credit goes to the tireless efforts of the Campaign for Southern Equality, which has been fighting for legal and lived equality across the South since 2011. Leading the organization since the start is founder Reverend Jasmine Beach Ferrara. And I am delighted to welcome her to State of Belief Radio. Jasmine, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
How in the world did you come to launch the campaign in the mountains of North Carolina in 2011?
That's a great question. I am a LGBTQ Southerner, and I grew up in North Carolina, so this landscape is very much home to me. And the folks involved with launching the Campaign for Southern Equality's work were also many LGBTQ folks from different parts of the South who really felt tremendously hopeful about what was possible in the South. And at that time in 2011, we thought there was a path to marriage equality in every Southern state by 2016. A lot of people told us we were crazy at the time, but we thought there was a way to do it. And lo and behold, we were part of many different organizations working to achieve that goal by 2015. We also knew, though, that the South was a place where there's tremendous need in the lives of LGBTQ Southerners and tremendous need and opportunity to be engaged on civil rights issues like immigration rights, racial justice and equity, and economic justice. So the moral imperative to do the work was here, but also the sense of hope and possibility.
So, Jasmine, did you really think marriage equality would come to the entire nation so quickly as it did?
We did. We thought there was a way to thread the needle through a combination of aggressive movement in the federal courts and public education, and specifically in the South, using direct action tactics that really helped to shine a light on the reality that LGBTQ folks literally live in every single town across the South and across the country, and exactly how harmful the laws that ban same-sex marriage were. We were a little outside the box in our thinking, but we thought, and we didn't think it was a sure thing, but we thought there was a path to get there as quickly as we did. And at the time, it was not uncommon to hear projections that it would be 2025 or 2030 before mm-hmm. marriage equality came to the South. The South is a place where when we do invest resources, and when we think about ways to, in the parlance of sports, to play both offense and defense, there oftentimes are a lot of untapped opportunities to help accelerate social change and get closer to that vision of justice and equity for everyone. And the South is so often characterized as the dragging edge of the nation, but there's also that adage that as the South goes, so goes the nation. And we really try to look at opportunities where the South can be a place where we're accelerating conversations and progress. And the work around marriage equality was one place where the South played, I think, a key role in ultimately getting there.
How were you able to expand the influence of the Campaign for Southern Equality as broadly as you've done?
Well, at the heart of the work we do is real people. And what we did is we barnstormed across the South, meeting with people in living rooms and church basements, coffee shops, and just having conversations. And what we heard was this incredibly powerful story. And honestly, it was a new story about LGBTQ life in the South, about people staying put rather than leaving. The research shows that one-third of LGBTQ Americans live in the South, and that's a data point that surprises a lot of people. But it's true, and you will feel that and see that and experience that as you travel the South. And what our work has been about, and our work has grown beyond, of course, marriage equality. We work around issues of health equity. A big part of our work is providing very early stage grassroots funding to folks in small towns and rural communities who are starting the first ever LGBTQ group to host a pride event or provide direct services. And what we heard from people from Petal, Mississippi to Morristown, Tennessee was we're ready to lead in our hometown. And what we need is the resources and support to get our ideas off the ground. And we need a network and a community standing behind us and having our back so that we know we're not alone. A friend of ours calls it porchlight organizing, where oftentimes, especially in smaller towns and rural communities where LGBTQ people live there but have long been pressured to live in the shadows and there's not historically been an organization working there focused on these issues, if one person or a group of people sort of turn on the porch light and say, hey, we're here, and we're going to share who we are, and we're going to be authentic about who we are, and we're going to show up at the local holiday parade waving our rainbow flags, it attracts people. And that's how we've seen our work grow, the way any movement grows, and it's how we see the work of incredibly vibrant grassroots groups across the South growing. It's through people recognizing kindred spirits and people being brave and courageous enough to do publicly what we do in our private lives all the time, which is to be honest and authentic about who we are and who we love.
Your mission statement is legal and lived equality. Would you talk about the distinction and about the different ways you have to work to achieve both parts of that goal?
When we talk about legal equality, we're talking about the threshold of whether LGBTQ people are regarded as equal under the law, guaranteed full equal protection, guaranteed equal treatment in every sphere of life. The reality in the South continues to be that LGBTQ folks are second-class citizens under the law. We lack basic protections against discrimination in the realms of employment and housing, for instance. And in some parts of the South, North Carolina, where we are, is one place, there's actually been a new wave of laws specifically targeting LGBTQ folks for discriminatory treatment. HB2 is a law that targeted our transgender brothers and sisters in North Carolina and received national and global attention for that fact. So when we talk about legal equality, we're talking first of all about removing the barriers to equality and ensuring that we are considered equal citizens under the law. But we're also talking more broadly about the sphere of policy, not just the laws that might pass in a state legislature or at the level of Congress, but we're talking about the laws, the administrative policies that exist in public schools, for instance, and sort of any public institution that is working with and engaging with LGBTQ folks. Mm-hmm. Changing laws and policies is a tremendous part of the arc of any civil rights movement. But what we certainly know as we think about the ongoing journey towards racial justice and equity in the United States is that changing laws is not in and of itself enough. And that when we talk about the concept of lived equality, whether we're talking about that for LGBTQ folks or immigrant brothers and sisters or people of color, we're talking about whether you have the opportunity in your daily life to thrive, to live up to your full potential, whether you're experiencing treatment associated with stigma and bias, for instance, when you try to access health care or as you're enrolled in a public school. This is informed by policy and law, but it's a whole different set of goals and a whole different type of work to do mm-hmm. around changing people's attitudes, hearts and minds, and creating communities where people have every opportunity to thrive. Mm. You know, our ultimate vision is a South where every person can thrive and have that experience both of being equal under the law, but also being treated equally as they move through public space.
Mm-hmm. Are faith leaders in the South an important part of the coalitions you've been able to put together?
Hugely important, yes. And oftentimes on the very front lines of civil rights and social justice issues, whether it's LGBTQ issues or immigrant rights in the South, and really in many cases prophetic voices, folks who are speaking out in the public square, not just from the pulpit, and really sharing this message from across faith traditions, Christianity, Judaism, Unitarian Universalist tradition, this message of equality, of justice, of dignity, and this message of hope. Certainly in my own life, but in the lives of so many people we work with, the ultimate source of their hope lives in their faith.
Mm. Historically, LGBTQ Americans have stayed safe by staying in the closet. It's only the courageous coming out of so many that has allowed the general public to come to know their LGBTQ neighbors. And as a consequence to that, to support equal rights for all. But by definition, those who remain in the closet remain unseen and unprotected. Would you talk about how widespread that kind of secrecy continues to be? Because I think a lot of people assume the closet is just a thing from the past.
It does continue. And at the same time, what we also see that's quite remarkable and very moving is that people are coming out at younger and younger ages. We had the opportunity at the Campaign for Southern Equality to host a summit this past weekend that brought together more than 100 LGBTQ middle schoolers and high schoolers and some parents and teachers as well. But mostly it was middle and high schoolers from across very rural counties in Western North Carolina who are coming out and may be the only person out at their school, but are feeling like they are ready to take that step. So yes, we do see people who, for a whole combination of reasons, cannot be out in the way they might wish to, mm-hmm. And I think carry an additional burden in their lives because of that. everyone I know who's LGBTQ, myself included, was in the closet at some point. So that's something everyone in our community can relate to and knows the often the great loneliness and pain of having to hide who you are and having to constantly worry that part of who you are will be detected. You know, something that's quite powerful is that we also hear so much resonance as we listen to the stories of our immigrant brothers and sisters, especially in the climate, the political climate right now, of folks having to just be so vigilant at all times about their safety and their identity. And to us, that speaks to sort of some of the deeper connections in these issues of, you know, when we see people persecuted, the kind of pressures that mount and the way that shows up in people's lives and what it means to lift up a vision of hope and liberation. And what it means for people increasingly to say, you know what, we're going to confront the power structures that seek to demean us and actually be out about who we are.
Jasmine, will you briefly tell our listeners how to stay informed on your work and how they can support that work?
Absolutely. We invite people from across the South, but also all across the country to be part of our work. You can learn about us at www.southernequality.org. You can sign up for our mailing list. We're also very active on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, pushing out daily content updates about our work, but also the work of other organizations across the South and sort of breaking civil rights news from across the South. And what we invite people to join us in being relentlessly hopeful about what's possible in the South. And also understanding the real urgency of what needs to happen today as we respond to real needs in our community.
The Reverend Jasmine Beach Ferrara is the executive director of the Campaign for Southern Equality, which she founded in 2011. An inspiring faith leader and effective change maker, she lives in Asheville, North Carolina, with her wife and three kids. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, and it's been lovely to get this time with you, and thank you for all you do to lift up stories like this from across the South.
This conversation is part of Whosoever You Love, our semi-monthly series affirming the worth and full value of LGBTQ persons within and beyond religion. Whosoever You Love is supported by the Arcus Foundation, which is dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and with the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org and find the entire series at www.whosoeveryou.love. There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with John Pavlovitz, author of the book Hope and Other Superpowers, A Life-Affirming, Love-Defending, Butt-Kicking, World-Saving Manifesto. And later, Rabbi Jack Moline will hear why he's hopeful about the Equality Act and the No Ban Act on Capitol Hill. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. John Pavlovitz is a best-selling author, a popular public speaker, and a columnist whose website attracts millions of readers every month. A former megachurch pastor, John has recently released Hope and Other Superpowers, A Life-Affirming, Love-Defending, Butt-Kicking, World-Saving Manifesto. And I am happy to welcome the author to State of Belief Radio. John, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
John, anyone spending some time reading your website, Stuff That Needs to Be Said, is likely to be struck by both the empathy and the outrage that you share in what seems such an unfiltered way. That kind of openness takes a lot of courage. How did you arrive at a point where you're comfortable doing what you do?
Well, I have been a local church pastor for 23 years, and the blog started a little bit later, and I was writing the blog just for people in my church, just for my local community, and I happened to write a piece about the Sandy Hook shooting at the time, and that reached a much larger audience. It reached outside of the people I thought I was writing to, and what that did was that sort of changed how I viewed what I was doing. I realized that I was had a responsibility to speak more explicitly into certain things, into matters of faith, in the way that the church was treating the LGBTQ community, and just what was happening in our country. And I got to the point where writing more explicitly began to create tension in the local church for me, to the point where I tell people I heard God calling me to leave my church, and it came in the form of my pastor's voice saying, "You're fired." And so for me, that was it was a releasing, because then I could write and speak really explicitly where maybe I couldn't before. And so it really isn't a matter necessarily of courage, but I think once you begin to live authentically and you begin to, you know, share life with people and you begin to have your eyes opened, you're just telling people what you see. And that outrage and that empathy are tied together, right? It is the compassion that sort of fuels all of this, because it's not just simply outrage. It's not a desire to hurt people, but it's really feeling deeply for the wounds that people are sustaining and wanting to speak into that.
Do you do the same thing in your writing?
Absolutely. For me, I travel the country almost every week right now, have been for almost 2 years, and I listen to people's stories, and then I sift those stories. I try to ask myself, what are they trying to say? What are the burdens that they're carrying? And so I'm always writing from that place of, you know, where is the burden? Where is the pain? And try to speak into that as clearly and as properly as I can. Try to be productive with the words that I share.
You're living honestly in a way that has not always been a part of your life.
Right. And, you know, people don't understand that that happens to pastors, that the pastor is by nature, they're in a political position of sorts because they're beholden to a group of people. And that's a beautiful thing, that they're in relationship with a certain group of people, a very specific group of people. And what happens, though, they can become sort of internally manipulated by that group of people because they don't want to get them angry. They don't want to jeopardize their relationship. And so often there's a softening, there's a, you know, couching of the language. Mm-hmm. And so I talk to pastors and ministers and all the time, and they're all dealing with it on some level, that there is sort of this internal conviction that they're feeling, and yet they know that they can't always speak fully and authentically. And so what I try to do is encourage ministers to be brave, not to speak or to preach or to write to get fired, but also not to speak or preach or write to keep a job. And I also encourage people in local faith communities to give their ministers permission to ask the questions, to doubt, to struggle, because I think that makes the community much more vibrant and much more healthy.
Mm-hmm. John, in reading your biography, I can't help but think of my friend Bishop John Shelby Spong, whose ability to speak bluntly and whose passion for inclusivity can be traced directly back to his evolution from a conservative background to a faithful understanding of God as love. Where have you been, and how did you get here?
Well, you know, for me, you know, the short story is became a pastor later in life and had experienced sort of an expanding of my table, going to college in Philadelphia, living in the heart of the city, and kind of being outside of the bubble that I had been raised in, and having a lot of things that about my theology challenged there. And so later, when I became a pastor, never quite felt that I was in lockstep with some of the things that the church might have been, the churches I was a part of. But, you know, you learn stories, you get truer stories about people, and then you feel compelled to share those. And so it was really a gradual evolution for me. It wasn't, you know, sort of a moment, but it was a slow chipping away at some of the theological beliefs that I had, or just the ideologies that I had been steeped in. And for at some point, you get to the point where you say, I can no longer be silent about this. And then so you begin speaking. And that leads you to the next place, into the next group of people, into the next group of stories.
There are so many distractions in the lives we lead today. In a way, that can actually be comforting, but it's also dangerous. So how do you keep yourself focused on what's most important? And how would you encourage listeners to do that as well?
Well, I think we have to be careful where we focus our energy. There's a couple things, you know, for me, the life of Jesus, there's all these times in the Gospels where they can't find Jesus and he's off to a solitary place praying. And I think he found that place of silence and solitude. I think that allowed him to recalibrate. And so when he approaches the crowds and he approaches all the need and the struggle, he can see them with compassion and not contempt. So I always instruct people to engage, but then withdraw, to not just engage. And part of that is our culture. Social media tells you to engage all the time. And it's also, you know, placing energy. Sometimes I'm placing that energy to oppose something, whether it's a mindset or a piece of legislation or whatever it could be. But then I have to make sure I'm giving some time simply to be with people and to care for people. So it's the same battle, if you will, but it's a very different energy when you're opposing something as to when you're relational with people. So I want, you know, people, I would have people make sure that they're having that full kind of holistic experience of their activism or their theology.
Yeah. We live in a politicized world, whether we like it or not. And I wonder what the politicization of almost everything has done in what you write about and in what you speak about. What is the most difficult for you now in expressing yourself?
Oh, I would say that probably people who will shut you off the moment that you approach something that feels political, that they've been taught is political. And so for me, it's trying to keep an audience with people who may think they disagree with me, but will find more commonality if they'll sit. You know, I remember I wrote a book called The Bigger Table and wrote most of the book, and the election, the 2016 election, had just happened. And so we sort of knew we needed to speak into that and place some of that content in the book. So I actually wrote the introduction in present time. So in 2016, the day after the election is where the book begins, and then it goes backwards. And there were people that didn't read the book simply because they got to the first page of the introduction and said, you know, this person was expressing grief for the election, therefore I'm going to turn this off. But I have heard so many stories of people reading and pressing through that and then saying, no, this is actually a story that's not very different than mine. So it's trying to overcome those sort of knee-jerk shutdowns that people have.
Early this month, you posted a succinct column on hope. It's the farthest thing from a feel-good platitude. In fact, you invoke names like Anne Frank, and the list of names reads almost like a liturgical litany. I know it's hard to summarize a powerful piece like this, but I'd like to ask you to try.
Well, it really, you know, began with, you know, reading Anne Frank's diaries recently and realizing the world that she lived in and the threats that she faced, and kind of seeing that sort of defiant joy and the hope that she was writing about the things that she believed in and hoping that one day she'd get to live these things out more fully. And it's just the idea that I'm here at this place in time and I've inherited that spirit, and I've got to, it's on my watch now. I have to figure out what to do in the face of things that cause me despair and anguish, and I can't fold and I can't stop because hopelessness is not an option. And so I just tell people that, you know, people are going to come far after us, and our responsibility now is to sort of steward that sort of arc of the moral universe that Martin Luther King talks about.
That's very good. John, if there's one thing you'd like every reader to take away from your book, what would it be?
I'd remind them of the impact of their lives, that the people who have changed and encouraged and challenged them likely aren't politicians or religious leaders or celebrities, they're likely, their lives have been changed by people that they knew and encountered in the kind of daily life. And so they have that same impact on humanity to remind them that they have a circle of influence in a neighborhood and a family and a church where their voice really carries. So to share that story and to use that voice and to realize this is how this work is done.
I want to put actually the previous question and this one together. We live, I said, we live in a politicized world. That's obvious. I deal with an awful lot of people who are no longer listening to the news. They're no longer reading the paper. They are really down in the dumps about our nation. What do you say to people like that?
You know, well, for me, as a white, cisgender, heterosexual Christian guy, I've had the luxury of saying, you know, I'm tired of the news or I'm burnt out on how bad things are. And I have to realize that many people, they have an urgency as a day-to-day sort of existence, and they don't have the option of stopping. They don't have the option of not engaging what's happening in the world. And so I want to make sure that I'm responsible and that I do that. So as disheartening as it is, I need to know what's happening, and I need to keep being able to be burdened by that. I can't not let those compassion muscles, you know, go into apathy. I can't let them atrophy. I've got to keep using them, because that's the, once you stop caring, then you've lost. And so I, to keep stoking that burden, to keep saying, what is it that gets me angry? What is it that frustrates me? What is it that grieves me? And then say, and so now what do I do about that? Where am I going to impact that thing?
Well, where do you see hope in our nation?
Well, I think it's easy to see as long as I had a gentleman at one of our Q&As at one of the talks recently, and he said, there are two news feeds in my life. He said, there is the news feed that I see that's sort of in front of me on social media and the news, and it's all bad and, you know, disconnect and all that. But he said, if I'm on the ground, if I'm paying attention in my local community, I see all sorts of signs of hope. Mm. I see people working in ministries or nonprofits or people helping in their neighborhoods or just, you know, decent people trying to figure out the best way to be human. And so that if I start to kind of dwell on those things, it becomes easier to walk into that world, because there's a truth there that I can see.
Our listeners will be hearing our conversation on Easter weekend. I'd love to have you talk about hope as a superpower.
Yeah, well, what hope to me is, it's aspirational. You know, hope is that thing that propels me into the day when I wouldn't otherwise want to walk into it, because what hope does is say, if I do the best that I can do and make the wisest decision, if I act in love today, then down the road in ways I can't, you know, see or predict, beautiful things will happen. And so hope is the essence of my faith journey growing up. It's the idea that, yes, things may appear one way, but if we keep moving, we will see something that we do not yet see.
John Pavlovist is a progressive Christian pastor, author, and public speaker. His writings appear online at his website, Stuff That Needs to Be Said. His latest book is titled Hope and Other Superpowers, a life-affirming, love-defending, butt-kicking, world-saving manifesto. John, I really want to thank you. I know you're under a lot of time pressures. Thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. I'm so grateful for the work you're doing and for the conversations you're having. So thank you so much.
From Muslim bans to trans bans to threats to women's rights, there's been a lot for Interfaith Alliance and its partners to resist and to raise public awareness of. But now, we're also seeing some legislative initiatives that the organization can actively work to promote. With details, I'm happy to be joined once again by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Welton, and some apologies for a little raspiness in my voice.
Diverse faith leaders have been speaking out in strong support of the Equality Act. I know you've endorsed this initiative personally, as well as leading an organization that is a coalition partner promoting this legislation. Why is this such a priority, Jack?
So, Alton, you know that the founders of our country left us with a profound mission statement that includes the affirmation that both by natural right and legislation, all people are created equal. We have, over the course of the years, enacted laws that have enfranchised people from different communities that had not been fully protected by the law, including people of color, including women, including people of various racial, ethnic, and religious minorities. And it is now time for us to turn our focus on the inequality of the law as regards people who are LGBTQ+. And that's what the Equality Act is all about. It is making good on the promise of America.
You know, I'm really glad to see the Equality Act has co-sponsors on both sides of the aisle. What does that tell us about what's changing with what has long been used as a polarizing partisan issue?
I think that the Marriage Equality Act that Interfaith Alliance did, mostly under your leadership, Welton, really was a turning point in this country in terms of its attitudes towards people who were gay or lesbian. In our society, it turns out, not surprisingly, to those of us who've been paying attention, that everybody knows and loves people who are homosexuals. And that while thinking about this abstractly, some people might want to invoke some sort of discomfort in the law, thinking about it in terms of someone you love makes all the difference in the world. And that work that came to a conclusion 4 or 5 years ago has now informed the mindset of people on both sides of the aisle, understanding that there are real consequences to holding forth on something theoretical when it affects someone you know and love.
I know Interfaith Alliance is also deeply involved with the No Ban Act. What do we need to know about this initiative?
Everybody knows intuitively what we need to know about this initiative. I don't have to remind anybody that one of the first things that President Trump did when he was inaugurated was to attempt to ban Muslims from certain countries that are primarily Muslim around the world. And I, along with thousands and thousands of other people, went to airports that first night of the ban to welcome people who were arriving and to express our concern about people who are not allowed to enter the country. This effort that is sponsored in the Senate by Senator Christopher Coons from Delaware, and in the House by Representative Judy Chu, is designed to make sure that nobody, not Muslims, not Hindus, not Sikhs, not Christians, not Jews, will be banned from this country on the basis of their faith. It will put into law what ought to be common sense.
What kind of support are you seeing for this bill so far?
The better question is, who's not supporting the bill? Because everybody that I know, everybody I talk to, all of our allies are in favor of this bill. To the dismay of the sponsors, there is as yet no co-sponsor from across the aisle. And if there are people listening to this who want to do something about it, if you have a member of Congress representing you, a senator representing you who has not signed on to be a co-sponsor of this, it's time to make a call and insist that they do it. But overwhelmingly, people understand that whatever reforms might be necessary in our immigration laws, those reforms do not include excluding classes of people based on their faith.
Jack, what's the coalition working to pass the No Ban Act look like? How broad is it?
The last count I saw, Welton, from Muslim Advocates was over 400 organizations. And that's a lot of organizations by any standard.
What are the other policy priorities Interfaith Alliance is focusing on right now?
Well, you know from your time sitting in this chair, and I've certainly seen it over the last 4 years, that there seem to be fewer opportunities for Interfaith Alliance to speak out about anti-Semitism. It's not that there wasn't anti-Semitism, it's just that the pressing nature of prejudice against other faith communities always seemed to be a little greater than that directed against the Jews, against the faith community that I'm a part of. But lately that's changed, and Interfaith Alliance will this week release a letter that will be sent the first part of the week to the leadership of the House and the Senate, expressing concern about things that have taken place actually on the floor of the House of Representatives, in which elected members of Congress and the Senate have been using anti-Semitic rhetoric to cast aspersions on people on the other side of the aisle, using it as a political tool. What prompts this specifically was the efforts of one member of Congress, I'm not going to name anybody because that's not what this is about, to cast political opponents and members of the media as the new iteration of Hitler's big lie that he wrote about in Mein Kampf. And in order to make that clear, this particular representative entered into the congressional record sections of Mein Kampf as part of the accusation against members of the House. I have to say that in my life, which is greater than 66 years now, never have I imagined that I would hear Adolf Hitler invoked to criticize a political party in the United States for doing its job, for being either the majority party proposing policy or the loyal opposition objecting to the efforts of the other side of the aisle. So we've been fortunate that we have been joined by an interfaith coalition to send a letter to the leadership of the House and the Senate objecting to weaponizing anti-Semitism for political purposes. It references the incident I spoke about, but it's not directed at the give and take and the flow of conversation that happens in the public arena on policy issues. It is directed at the way that people are leveling charges of anti-Semitism or leveling anti-Semitism to disparage political opponents for political purposes. And we've had some very good response to this letter. All four of the major denominations of Judaism have signed on to this letter. Those inside the Jewish community know how unusual that is. And we have representatives from the Christian community, the Muslim community, and the faith-based organizing community that are specifically not Jewish. We're very grateful for that.
Jack, I am happy to be able to say that a few weeks from now, Interfaith Alliance will be awarding the 2019 Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. I would like for you, if you would, to talk about that, who is being honored and why.
Thank you, Welton. We're actually very excited about this. Judge William Webster is a former federal judge, later the director of the FBI and the CIA, served under numerous presidents. He himself has identified as a Republican during his active years in government, but has willingly served in the administrations of every president who has asked him to do so, and many of them have. He is the man who managed to reimagine what it meant to be an FBI agent that did not include the definition as a young white male with a crew cut. He really managed in his long career to open up that kind of service to the government, to all different kinds of people, and we're glad for that. We're also honoring Peter Mayer, who is the retired CBS White House correspondent for CBS Radio, who himself is very much in the mold of Walter Cronkite, a man with tremendous personal integrity, and a man whose politics you would not have known until he retired from broadcasting, which is very much how Mr. Cronkite was to us. And we're looking forward to that on May 21st. We have a fascinating and fantastic venue. And anybody who's going to be in or near Washington on May 21st, we'd love to have you join us. And you can find details about the event on our website beginning Monday. That information will be there Monday morning if you'd like to register to be a participant in this extraordinary evening.
Jack, some of our listeners are not going to be able to be in Washington for that. Is there a way they can feel to be a part of this?
Well, I wouldn't want to miss the opportunity to suggest that if you contribute to Interfaith Alliance in honor of Judge Webster or Mr. Mayor, it will make you a part of the festivities. And we promise that as soon as we're able, we'll have all sorts of stuff up on our website that will make people feel like they were there, just as we did for Khizr Khan and Diane Reen just 2 years ago. I hope they'll check in with us, and I hope they will be generous in tribute to the man who meant so much to Interfaith Alliance during his lifetime, and in tribute to these two great Americans who have advanced the course of true religious freedom in their careers. If you go to www.interfaithalliance.org, there is a plethora of information on our policy issues put there by Katie Joseph, who is our John and Eula May Baugh policy and education staff member. It will tell you exactly what we're working on. And you'll also find there a terrific link to five facts you should know about various religious communities, faith communities in the United States, which is a much overlooked resource for people who are going to be interacting with their neighbors and would like to know a little bit more about it. And that's especially important at this time of the year when Jews and Christians and Sikhs and, in very short order, Muslims are celebrating major holy seasons of their lives.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, Protecting Faith and Freedom for All. Find more information about the work of the Alliance as well as about the Walter Cronkite Award ceremony at, I'll say it again, interfaithalliance.org. Jack, it's always great to talk with you, and thanks for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, and I always look forward to hearing from you with good wishes at both of our holy times. Let me encourage our listeners to do that for each other. Thanks.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, you've just helped make this happen. Let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important for others to hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. We appreciate your support. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.